These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, part two, Movement and Memory, Reflections on Labor and the Genealogy of Resistance, with Baba Saladin Muhammad. Africa World Now Project is next. Saladin Muhammad argues in an article titled Black Workers for Justice, 21 Years of Struggle, in Against the Current, that the national oppression of African Americans in the South makes black workers in the South the most exploited section of the U.S. industrial working class. Black Workers for Justice thus base its trade union and political perspectives on the principle of the centrality of the black working class. The struggle against racism, for political power, and self-determination for African-descended people are key aspects of this principle in forging the unity of the Southern and U.S. working class. Black Workers for Justice has tried to create an identity, confidence, and political presence of the black worker and trade union organization in the U.S. South. Black Workers for Justice believes that the struggle against African-American national oppression must take on sharper black working class and internationalist features. It must put forward a perspective for and be active in building a strong, rank-and-file, democratic, and radical labor movement in the U.S. South. It is with this Saladin Muhammad firmly situates Black Workers for Justice in the continuity and long arc of black liberation movements that center the black working class and the black worker, such as, but not limited to, the Ad Hoc Committee for Concerned Black Steelworkers, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, League of Revolutionary Black Workers. These are just some of the few radical black labor movements that are centered in the black liberation movement. What you will hear next is part two of our conversation with Baba Saladin Muhammad. Be sure to tap in to part one to pick up on the flow of our conversation. Part one can be found on all podcast platforms. Saladin Muhammad is an organizer, theoretician, and writer who has published a number of articles that explore issues ranging from exposing the structural and systemic racism in labor to ways to understand the interdependence of human rights and black internationalism. Saladin Muhammad is co-founder and national chair of Black Workers for Justice, and until his retirement, he was an international representative for United Electrical Workers. His praxis has been forged in black freedom work for more than three decades. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Listen intently, think deeply, act accordingly. Enjoy the program.
Know them, you know, because that kind of contact, the movement wasn't a distance from our homes. So I mean, you know, I got it kind of molding and shaping, you know.
No, Baba, I wanted to chime in here because that's you're talking about that space in between spaces that we talk about. So the space of creating or institutionalizing a movement and having the infrastructure, but also there's these spaces in between that you're talking about here, coming into contact with folk that other people may, you know, look at in a certain level of regard, but they're also people that are just around. and also living, also, you know, maybe playing basketball, you know, doing all of the things in the context that I think a lot of times when those people who study movements and things, they forget that, you know, these were human beings. We were human beings. They were human beings attempting to restructure the fundamental inequities that are inherent in the settler colonial system. And those spaces become important. And that's what I think that you are highlighting. And I will be very, very, if you remember anything that if you remember what you wrote in Making of a Black Revolutionary, I would love, and I'm sure our listeners would love to hear maybe a little bit about what were you thinking, and how, you know, what was it in that particular paper that you wrote as you were reflecting about the, you know, that moment being in Denver?
Well, you know, I think I was probably upset. I had to be forced out of, you know, where I lived at. You know, I lived a block and a half from where the shootout occurred with the dough pushers, a block and a half. You know, people would say, well, are you crazy? You know, you just walk. But I liked the area, you know, where I grew up. So I was probably, it's a combination of what I read, you know, in terms of the autobiography of Malcolm and stuff I read from Boggs, Jimmy Boggs, and stuff I read in The Crusader from Robert Williams, and the anger, you understand, of these jokers, you know, destroying our communities, you know, and having to been forced out with my family. You just, and that's what I wrote about in The Making of a Black Revolutionary, because I can remember vaguely. Now this is this was 51 years or 52 years ago when I wrote it. I remember, I don't know whether I was ending it or near ending it, and I said something about, you know, the system of oppression had to go, and it was really it was worded pretty much like that. And had to go was also equating the drugs with the system, you know. And it was more than that. I can't, you know, I've talked about that paper a number of times, and it's been hard to remember, you know, its content. But I'm sure that other papers and documents and a couple of pamphlets that I wrote
Build on that. It was very important, you know, to kind of talk about that, because what you really, that's exactly what I wanted to get to, is that this, you have it, there's an intellectual genealogy here, right? So these moments are happening, you're reflecting upon them, but you're also filtering through some, you know, some of the things that, you know, of course, James and Grace, you know, James Boggs is writing, and Robert F. Williams is writing. You mentioned, you know, the idea of, I'm sure folk will see a clear institutionalization, attempt to institutionalize a lot of the particular activities that you guys were involved in. And you were, of course, involved on some level, to some degree, to a number of institutions. And you talked about the Young African Nation, but you also talked about a little bit of the Republic of New Africa. Could you talk about that relationship, or how the Republic of New Africa is developing, and how this, because of course, in this particular period that you're talking about, there's a strong sense of developing, obviously, a nationalist, revolutionary nationalist, a nationalist agenda, which also leads to the 1972 Gerry Convention. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, how these organizations, how you guys are seeing yourselves, again, as a nation within a nation, but also trying to institutionalize that. And you, again, you have the organization that you guys are developing. You mentioned the Black Garment. You mentioned that a number of times that I would definitely want to, you know, kind of tease out of our conversation a little bit. But talk about how, you know, this period, to give a sense of the folk who are listening, to give a sense, because there are a number of people who write about this stuff, but don't necessarily have a particular connection to it. whether it's a family connection or, you know, those types of things. So there's a lot of the writing and a lot of the people, a lot of the literature and information that has been coming out is really disassociated from the actual on the ground, the actual things that were happening at that time. So could you talk a little bit about, you know, how these groups are forming, how you saw yourselves in relation to all of this nationalist tendencies that were happening at this time?
Well, yeah, you know, my experience, you know, probably the first 7 years were shaped by the general nationalist orientation. We didn't see ourselves as what has been described as cultural nationalists. You know, we understood culture, but you know, Mao Zedong in China talked about a cultural revolution to change social relations, to change, to establish the differences between the elite or the so-called bourgeois culture and the culture of the working class or the oppressed. And so many of us, you know, looked at culture in that way. And some of us were probably, didn't have, you know, some of us perceived maybe a culture as some form of liberalism or something of that nature at that time, you know. During that period of the 60s and 70s, the relationship between the African People's Party, RAM, the African People's Party, to the Republic of New Africa was such that we were like sister organizations. In fact, RAM elements had begun to build a network, a kind of movement infrastructure, you know, that had members that helped to form the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, the Republic of New Africa, the Black Panther Party. Very early on, the New York Black Panther Party was really formed before the Oakland Black Panther Party. And so RAM really was core to building that kind of infrastructure, had elements in the Black arts, in the Black studies movement, like John Bracey, that's up at Amherst, you know, wrote several volumes on revolutionary Black nationalism. People like Ernie Allen, who also was at UMass Amherst, but he comes out of California, and he was a member of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, one of the theoreticians in it. Some of these elements were in RAM that moved to build, but RAM was pretty much underground in terms of its visibility. So it was that kind of a connection there. I remember at the National Black Economic Development Conference in Detroit in 69, I think it might've been in March or something like that. I can't remember 69. Where I met Gaidi. His name was Gaidi. He was Imari Obadali's brother, older brother. They were from Philadelphia originally, you know, and he was a lawyer. Gaidi was a founder of Gold Group on African leadership or African American leadership. He was the one that helped Malcolm when Malcolm went to Africa. Reverend Clegg out of Detroit. All of them were connected, you know. Boggs was in Detroit. Boggs, you know, they knew each other, but Boggs, you know, had a different kind of an orientation. Boggs was an auto worker, you know, still writing while he was in the plant, you know. At the Black Economic Development Conference, Imari and the Black Legionnaires, this is when I first met Chokwe. Chokwe was young and he wasn't a lawyer. He was, he probably had just joined the Republic of New Africa. Cause that was the same year or the year after the meeting at Aretha Franklin's father's church, where the Republic of New Africa was really founded. And I remember Imari rising to the floor and said that, you know, he was leaving. It was a kind of a split or something that happened at the Economic Development Conference. And he said, we're going home to the South, to the Black Nation. And it was, he started moving to Mississippi, and it wasn't long after that, around 71, that the shootout happened in Mississippi, and he got locked up, and some other people got locked up, you know, 71 Mississippi kind of thing. But they seemed to part ways. Rob was coming back into the country then. Robert Williams was coming back in the country, and they stopped him. I think they stopped him in the UK some kind of way. You know, I think he was coming back from maybe China or something, you know, stopped him in the UK. And a number of people was waiting for him at the airport, but he didn't come in. All of this reflected some connections between the nationalist forces, you know, RNA, APP. Ram, and this was around 68, Ram had officially dissolved, you know, officially dissolved, but the Black Guard emerged, and then the, you know, eventually the APP, so I mean, you know, you know, dissolve is just a relative term, you know. So there was that kind of relationship, but there were differences. We had differences. They weren't antagonistic differences. So I mean, with that kind of relationship, you know, that had existed between most of the national kind of organizations that were identified as nationalists and revolutionary nationalists back at that time. I didn't meet Rob until 70, I don't know whether it was 72, or he got back in the country, or it may have been a little later. I know we met, and we were creating a coalition of sorts against the, I think it was probably against the 76 bicentennial that was in Philadelphia. He at that time was trying to situate himself as he come back into the country, and they still wanted to jail him, and he wanted to go back to Monroe, but he really wasn't able to go back, you know, to his home, you know, to organize and that kind of thing, you know. You know, it was interesting, you know, to hear from him and to hear about the Operation Dixie radio broadcast that he developed in Cuba, you know, that it was, you know, and so, you know, you really, you know, started to get a sense, you know, of Cuba's role in relationship to the African diaspora, you know, African, you know, and starting with this, the Black liberation struggle in the U.S., you know, starting with that, you know, and I mean, it's a lot of, you know, experience. I met Amiri Baraka, Leroy. Well, I first met him in 68. We, some members of the Young African Nation, the Guard, we went over to Newark to help campaign and door knocking for Gibson. Kenneth Gibson was the first black mayor of Newark. He lost in the 68. When we were in 68, lost to 69, I guess, took up, but he eventually won and became mayor. And it was quite interesting, you know. Again, I met him. I was at that, what one would say, or how one would be described, as we weren't equals necessarily. He was, you know, more advanced, et cetera, you know. And I remember at the Gary Convention, he would I joked with him. I said, damn, you got a whole bunch of Nehru outfits. You know, he wore, you know, he was sharp. Every time I would see him, you know, two or three times a day at the convention, you know, he was changed up, you know. I was kind of communicating between Max Stanford, Muhammad Ahmed, and him, because myself and Queen Mother Moore, who was in the African People's Party, and she has a history, you know, a long history, go back to the Garvey move. We were trying to get to see if Muhammad Ahmed would be able to speak, and he was in exile anyway. But then we wound up trying to get Queen Mother to speak on behalf, and they put Queen Mother all the way back to the end of the program. And she was, you know, talking about Muhammad Ahmed need for support and this and that, et cetera. You know, Amiri and I wound up having a debate that was moderated by a brother who was in the African People's Party, who was in RAM. His name was Askia Muhammad Touré. Askia Touré was a hell of a poet, you know, hell of a poet. Umbra, the different elements. We all lived together in a collective with Philadelphia, you know, and we were order paddle. It was myself, Amiri, and somebody who was from the Nation of Islam at that time. He was from one of the split offs from the Nation of Islam. And so Amiri looked at me, you know, we looked at each other. It was like, Amiri said, like, well, I guess we equals, you know. he was good cat, you know. He had a lot of humor with him, and he had became a Marxist. By that time, I guess I had became a Marxist, a materialist. I mean, I never called myself a Marxist. And it wasn't because I had any problem with Marxism. I was studying, you know, but I coming out of the nationalist movement, where I was always pushing back against all truths came from white people, you know, and so you know, we would see ourselves as revolutionary nationalist scientific socialists. So we would always call ourselves scientific socialists as opposed to just Marxists at that time. I mean, you know, I don't necessarily have any problem with that now, you know, even though I still would refer to myself, you know, as a scientific socialist, you know. But, you know, we was going at it, you know, and you know, he came to a church that was an allied church of ours. And was a debate, you know, and the preacher was real close to us, but his deacons, you know, wasn't so close. Was like, wow, you know, why, you know, but he was going to follow the will of the preacher. So they led us in the church, and this deacon was there. He opened the church and this and that. Then Amir, he gets up. And he said something. He said Jesus was a revolutionary with a big machine gun, and boy, you know, I tried to look out the side of my eye without looking at the deacon. You know, he was sitting there over there. You know, like I said, I told him, man, that's boy, you came in, and you trying to destroy our base, man. What? he laughed. You know, I said, boy, you. I said, you a dirty dog, man. You come in and try to destroy our base. I mean, had a big machine gun. And yeah, he was a... you know, they didn't put us out, you know. But I'm sure he gave a report to the preacher, you know. The preacher probably, I don't know, man, the preacher, he was a good cat. He probably would have said, hey, man, you know. Be careful the next time or something like that, you know, but it was that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, you know, all of these, you start to grow in the movement, you know, from being an absolute listener. I continue to listen. You got to listen and learn, but being almost an absolute listener to, you know, in awe sometimes of forces. And then later on, really seeing yourself as being a part of a movement, you know, and playing a role, making some sacrifices, you know, running and everything else, you know, and getting locked up and those kinds of things. So, I mean, it's been an experience, you know, and this toughened me up as I moved to North Carolina, you know, toughened me up. My wife is from here. And when I was in the military, I was foolish enough to become a paratrooper. And it's still, you know, gang orientation, you know, you're gonna follow the crew, you know. But when I was stationed at Fort Bragg, you know, I went in the military. I was making $68 a month. That was my pay, $68 a month. You go in the military now, you're making, you know, over $1,000, you know, that kind of thing. But I wanted to get away from there and go someplace. So I come and stay with my mother's sisters here in Rocky Mountain, you know, and my wife said I had my uniform on or something. You know, at that time, you know, and the girls, you know, I say that girls because that's what were young, you know, supposedly they were attracted to the uniform, you know, that thing. So I met my wife and, you know, my future wife and, you know, those kind of things. And we went to Philly and stayed up in Philly about 15 years and been down here about 46 years, I mean, 41 years.
That was a very great transition because I wanted to get into, you know, the transition from, you know, Philadelphia to North Carolina. I wanted to just kind of back up a little bit. I neglected to say this a little bit more about, you know, just the influences and the people that you work with, who influenced you, and also vice versa, you influencing them. You mentioned Queen Mother Moore. Could you talk a little bit more about her influence on your trajectory as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Queen Mother Moore was, you know, she was the leader in the African People's Party. You know, in fact, she had led the formation of a party in 68, you know, All African People's Party for National Liberation. But I met Queen Mother in, it was 69, and Muhammad Ahmed was really key to bringing Queen Mother into my life in terms of the movement. And she was something. In fact, I remember we had a central committee meeting right at the house that I'm living in right now. This was my wife's mother's house. And my wife's mother said, Queen Mother, you can take my bed. You know, so Queen Mother slept in my mother-in-law's bed. And we had meetings and people came around, Queen Mother, you know. Queen Mother was probably around 70 something, around then, you know. And she was, you know, we would sit around her and she would talk. I remember her, she was serious, but, you know, kind of joking. And she says, you know, if it wasn't for so many of y'all getting locked up, there wouldn't be no movement because we had these defense campaigns and everything, you know. And see, Queen Mother used to be, early on, was in the Communist Party, the U.S. Communist Party. And she would tell us stories about, you know, she worked in a kind of a dress factory. She would, you know, put the dresses on, you know, for size and this and that. You know, was organizing and she was part of the garbage movement. You know, when she was, she was born in New Iberia, Louisiana. And she came to New Orleans because Garvey was there to speak. You know, she always tells the story, you know, and the sheriffs and stuff didn't want Garvey to speak, you know. And so they all came in with weapons, you know, and Garvey said something about they won't let me speak. And said people jumped up and said, speak, Garvey, speak. And the sheriff, you know, everything. So It was really a very militant action at that time. But Queen Mother she was an inspirer. She was an advisor, you know, and she was a real elder, you know, hell of a public speaker. In fact, she was named Queen Mother in Ghana. I'm not sure whether it was, you know, during a period when Kwame was alive or whether it was at his funeral. I'm not sure. I can't remember. But yeah, they named her, made her Queen Mother. And her sister was closer to Malcolm than she was. Her sister, who was older than she was. I don't care, remember how much older. She introduced Queen Mother to Malcolm, and Queen Mother really talked to Malcolm about reparations and all that. Malcolm hadn't, you know, because the Nation of Islam wasn't dealing with that at the time. So they had about 250 acres of land in Catskill called Mount Addis Ababa. They named it Mount Addis Ababa. We would go up there, train up there, you know, and have meetings up there. It was, you know, in fact, we had moved Abner Berry, who was a mentor to me, you know, for a while. We brought Abner here to Rocky Mountain. He stayed here with us, you know. But Queen Mother was, you know, she was a real, I remember being in a Central Committee meeting in Philadelphia, and a comrade and my wife, my partner, came and knocked on the door. I knew something was going on because my father had been really ill. And the brother said, your father just died, you know. And I went back in, you know, and they heard it. I said, well, my father just died. I said, but, I'll wait until the our meeting is over. Queen Mother said, no, you won't. You're going now, you understand? You know, and you're going to take care of your family, and, you know, you got an obligation to do that. We got this. You know, we got that. You're going now. She says, you know, some wounds don't heal. You know, so you got to deal with that, you know. And I left. That was the kind of person and, you know, relationship the Queen Mother had to us. I mean, she was a fighter, but she, you know, was just, this was 75, 1975, and, you know, still young, you know, she probably said, well, you know, look, certain, you know, you have to know that the movement supports you, you know, you could be in something and sometimes it's our own errors, and sometimes it's the error of misleadership, you understand, you know, to disregard critical moments in your life, to disregard it, you know, revolutionary, you know, and the, we were young, you know, and we in 1968, you know, the word was put out that the revolution was going to begin. I could remember a crew of us waiting in a dark storefront inside, all equipped up, you know, waiting for it. Now, Stokely was supposed, no rap was supposed to be on the White House steps calling for revolution, and it may have been Bobby or Huey. One of them was someplace else supposed to be calling for revolution. So, you know, as far as we were concerned, you know, this was an urgent, nothing else mattered. Nothing else mattered. this was it, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, sometimes, you know, our assessment of the periods that we're in, you know, could be overestimation or, you know, assessment, and you don't see nothing, but, you know, in that, you know, but Queen Mother, you know, she had a grasp, you know, look, if he, you're gone now, you know, how, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, somebody else might have said that. I might have tried to say, well, I can handle it, you know, queen mother, you know. But she was, she taught us a lot. And she was very, very close to a number of fighters, many who come out of the old Communist Party movement, but who were, I mean, people like Jesse Gray and James Horton, and all these are elements who were real key. Jesse Gray was the founder of the Harlem Tenants Council early on. You know, all of them had places in Mount Addis Ababa, you know, that they would, you know, go to and that kind of thing. But Queen Mother was quite a influence. In fact, Queen Mother is the one who recruited Abner Berry to the African People's Party. And he became my mentor in Philadelphia, you know, and, you know, really, we really became real, real close. He would drive to Philly from Newark. I'm talking about three times a week or more, you know, or the weekend and stay, you know, and he had old volumes of linen and, you know, stuff from Marx, you know, and he would let me read them and we would discuss them together, you know, and that kind of stuff, you know. But he was, there's one thing about Abner. We brought Abner down here. Abner was 80. He lived till he was 86. He had a sense of humor about him, but he would meet with us. His patience was such that one would sometimes think that, you know, a person who, he had a stroke then, we had to bring him down in the wheelchair, that he would be impatient with mistakes, you understand? Like, well, I ain't got much time left. I can't handle, you know, but he was, you know, we never felt a push, you know, that's been tied to that at all. Never felt a push, you know. I've tried to, embrace, you know, that thinking, you know, haven't been always successful, you know, but I tried to embrace that thinking. He became a plaintiff, one of three plaintiffs that was in the Black Workers for Justice of a lawsuit here in Rocky Mountain, where they had a, what call an at-large system, which meant that people were not able to elect people from the districts or the wards that they were in, you know. And so Abner and two other brothers became plaintiffs. One lawsuit opened up, you know, for there to become a Black majority on the city council of Rocky Mountain. Now, when the suit was filed, the city council and the newspaper, they came out with stuff saying, this Abner Berry, he was a part of the highest ranking committees in the Communist Party, you know, because when they came after Dr. King and they came at the Highlander Center, they said that the Highlander Center was a communist center and that Dr. King, you know, was being influenced by the Communist Party. If you Google the Highlander, the board, was a big bulletin board like you would see on a highway signs, and they had Dr. King, and they had Abner Berry was bending down writing, and that was the thing that they used to try to isolate King and said he was part of the Communist Party. Well, Abner, that was Abner. So they came out with all that stuff, you know, and Abner. Abner said, we called him Baba Sufu, Elder Teacher. We named him that in 1970. Elder Teacher, 70, 71 maybe. And he was a smoker. So my children, you know, and I think maybe my granddaughter at that time, one of my granddaughters at that time, Abner said, you light him a cigarette. And they would light him a little cigarette up. You know, they had little cigarette holes because he rolled his, he had one of these cigarette rollers, you know, and it would just, had little holes in his shirt from the cigarette, you know, ashes falling. But Abner said, he said, let him come. Let him come. He says, just imagine, you understand, my last fight will be a fight for self-determination. This is around the lawsuit stuff. And so when Jackson in 85 was running for president, Jesse Jackson, well, Jackson came to Rocky Mount because we were involved in a union campaign, and he came to speak, you know, and had these fans, you know, was escorting me, you know, came to this church, this black church. Now you stop some of the racism. This was a union called Act Two, Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union, the Southern region. And this guy, Bruce Rayner, he says, he was the president of the Southern region. So we want to bring him here, but we want to try to not get him in some of these black churches. He wanted, boys, you know. So anyway, we said to the, go find a white church, you know. That was what I said, go find a white church. So the white workers, they came back, you understand, and they said that their pastors, you understand, said, no, they didn't want to have no Jesse Jackson, no black people, you know, that kind of thing. So he came to a black church, you know, Ebenezer Baptist Church. It was packed. And it was some white workers, probably about 60 white workers came. It was packed, I mean, really packed. This cat, Bruce Rayner, who was the president, he didn't feel no whites was going to come over there. Anyway, Jackson started talking about voting rights, and they brought Abner in a wheelchair up on the stage, lift his arm up, you understand, you know, congratulating him, you know, for fighting for voting rights, you know. Abner, you know, we were fortunate that he was here. I mean, I could walk. Well, he stayed with us for a while, then got him in a kind of a seniors, a kind of hookup, you know. I could walk to it, you know. And he was something he used to say to us all the time. He said, to y'all young people, I could see way, way, way down the road. Way down the road, you know, and that kind of thing, you know. But yeah, he was, him and Queen Mother, they were great mentors to me and to other comrades.
I definitely wanted to get into that transition, because this is also, of course, Abner Berry and Queen Mother Moore, you're in Philadelphia, right? You're developing, you're working, you're moving, you're developing, you know, a critical consciousness, you're being connected. I also want to ask one quick question. You weren't in Philadelphia when the MOVE bombing happened, were you? I think you were a bit down in North Carolina at that particular point.
Not the MOVE bombing, but the first MOVE attack. We were there. In fact, we organized. We organized. In fact, they had one of these, we call it a horse. This is like a kind of a, almost like a blockade, you know, nothing immovable or anything, but it was, you know, something that supposed to, you know, prevent you. We knocked that down, you know, because they were trying to, originally Rizzo had threatened to flood the house, send the fire department in to flood the house. Now, we went a delegation. In fact, I was responsible for pulling together a delegation. Father Paul Washington, who was a Church of the Advocate with the Black Power Conference, was added in the Black Panther Constitutional Convention party that was held there. Father Washington was a brother named Blackwell, who was a city council person at that time. About five or six of us. And I think Gwen Simmons, Zohara Simmons might have been, we went in the house. We went in the MOVE's house. Because they were threatening. It was said that there was a dead child in the house, and MOVE view was, you know, ashes, you know, a natural kind of thing, you know. And so we went up, you understand, to try to, you know, have a talk to find out whether we can get out of this damn thing, you know, without without them flooding the house or shooting the house up. And we wound up coming back. It was Delbert and a number of MOVE people were there. We came out, and they were in there for a while. And then when we moved away, then some shooting began. A cop got killed in the 78. This was the 78. That was the MOVE, the 78, you know, MOVE. You know, we, this was a different location from where the bombing took place. It was still in what they call the Powhatan. This was the Powhatan Village section of Philadelphia. And we had, you know, generally a good relationship MOVE at that time. You know, differences, we had differences, but kind of united front stuff that went down. When we were young, we think we had a pretty good a sense of the city and a sense of, when they started to MOVE, you know, fire alarms started to be pulled all over the city. And you know, this was aimed at pulling people back away from it. I don't know who did it, but that's what happened, because anybody who had dreadlocks was being snatched out off the street by the police in 78, because they were seen as maybe being a part of this MOVE group, you know, that kind of thing. So
yeah, I wanted to shift a little bit, if you don't mind, because I know I don't have much time left with you, and also want to respect your time. And there are a number of things that we didn't get to that hopefully we can have another conversation. But we also want to talk about this transition into North Carolina. You mentioned Abner Berry, you mentioned Queen Mother Moore, and you gave a little bit, you know, of who Abner Berry was and how important he was in formulating your thoughts and the folk that you guys were organizing with. So you moved to North Carolina, and you know, you mentioned the case and the development. You briefly mentioned Black Workers for Justice. Could you talk a little bit more about Black Workers for Justice, its development, but also what it did, and also your organizing in connection with that and other formations in North Carolina around workers?
Well, Black Workers for Justice formed in 81, and it formed out of a struggle of Black workers at Kmart. Some women had been fired unjustly and treated unjustly, and so we organized around that. I had just come into Rocky Mount early that year, and my aunt, she had played piano at this church of this young minister at that time. He was about 20, 21 or something. He was around 21 when he came to their church. Anyway, I heard that there was going to be a meeting over there for some workers that had been wrongfully fired, a meeting of what they call the Black Ministerial Alliance. So I went in and I listened. You know, I was new. I didn't really know anybody. And these three women, they were being interrogated. You know, are you sure you did what you was told? What about the company policies? Blah, 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 blah. I was like, you know, like, wow, you know. So, you know, I was sitting there, you know, and I said, could I ask the question? The first one minister said, well, who are you? You know, I said who I was, and I said, I'm the nephew of Roxy Freeman. That was the piano player at the church that was being held, you know. So it's like, you know, okay. So Reverend Walker, who was the pastor of the church, said, well, yeah, he's all right, you know. We hadn't even met each other, you know. So I asked a question. I can't remember exactly. And the sister, yeah, you know, they asked the question, you know, going through this and that. So as it went forward, you know, I said, I wonder if we could meet and then come back to the pastors, the Minister Alliance, you know, at another time, you know. And they was in a hurry, you understand, to get it out. But we did, you know, and we talked, we met, you know, listened, and, you know, you find out things, you know. At that point, you know, that these were three women who the all-male preachers, minister alliance, you know, was like, how credible is this, or probably, you know, a view, you know how women are, they just complain about anything, you know, that kind of thing, you know, you can you could have a, you could sense that, right? So we talked about the issues, and I asked, I said, well, are there any other workers who still work at Kmart, you know, who have these issues concerned? Yeah. They brought back probably about 15 other workers, you know, to a meeting. And I think all except for one were women, Black women. And they developed demands, I think it was 9 demands, and they named themselves Black Workers for Justice at Kmart. That's what they were called, Black Workers for Justice at Kmart. And, you know, we began a struggle. I, having had connections with forces that were tied to the African Liberation Support Movement, and also the National Black United Front that was formed in 79 in New York. Reverend Daughtry was the was chair at that time. And so I went to a United Front meeting in Raleigh, Black United Front meeting in Raleigh. And I saw a few people who had been up in the New York meetings and, you know, ALSC, et cetera, and, you know, talked about Kmart. I think the Kmart worker was with me. And they helped to push it out to some other rural, to some rural counties, et cetera. And we had a boycott, and we weren't able to win the jobs back, but we got the manager fired, and or at least transferred. Some people say he was fired, but somebody else said he was transferred. And we, you know, we kind of established a movement. We got the petition signed, and most people were knocking on doors or going to their churches. I went to the city and met with some city workers, and I went to a textile plant, met with some, was getting petition signed at these places. And I remember them saying, man, we need something like this here. We got problems here too, you know, and that kind of thing. So anyway, a number of people were reached out to that, and we eventually, you know, I had a founding assembly and dropped Kmart, adopted the program and became Black Workers for Justice. So we had representatives from around 10 counties, you know, 10 mainly rural counties that was formed. And, you know, Abner was very key in helping to figure out how do we now deal with an organization, you know, that was largely in Eastern North Carolina, many from the rural areas, and, you know, and recognizing that there was a kind of a difference between between the rural communities and the urban area. You know, so many of these were things, you know, that I hadn't considered in terms of the dynamics and those kinds of things, you know. So, you know, we learned about that, about the pace of organizing, you know, and North Carolina, you know, had not been a very strong part of concentration during the civil rights period, except, you know, maybe Greensboro in terms of the sit-ins, you know, at the Woolworths and that kind of stuff, you know. But Eastern North Carolina, not so much. I mean, you had the NAACP, and you had a little bit of it, you know, a funeral director was supporting the boycott of Woolworth, but it wasn't a Birmingham or wasn't a Montgomery, you know, when I say it didn't have a strong image. However, King had come to a Rocky Mount, you know, and supposedly his I Had a Dream speech was first tested out in Rocky Mount, you know, at OIC, a location that became OIC. It was been a high school, Booker T. Washington High School. But again, you know, the rural characteristics in terms of organizing and going out in the rural areas, you know, and really seeing the Klan, they were heavily in the rural areas, you know, hearing what people would talk about and those things. So, you know, we formed, and then we started very intentionally targeting some workplaces, you know, forming. Some of us became hired by some of the trade union, you know, and there's a whole lot connected to that. We mobilized probably as early as 83 for the demonstration. I think Stevie Wonder was pretty key to that around a holiday for Dr. King. So we had a petition campaign, everything. We mobilized people on buses, you know, to go to DC and participated in that. And so we began to branch out. Then was around that same, around the 83 time that we filed, the lawsuit was filed around the voting rights stuff. So it was a whole bunch of, you know, kind of activities, marches, and those kinds of things. So.
No, that you're insightful and very important comment about the pace of organizing is very, very important, because of course you're highlighting a number of things, but it was in the course of time. You know, I don't want to you know, keep you any longer, and I wanted to ask you, I wanted to really get into or ask you about your internationalist worldview and some of the influences for that. But I will defer to you and say, you know, we can have a part two specifically talking about that, the internationalist view that you developed, the worldview, and what was the contributions for that. Or if you feel that you can answer that, you know, in just a few minutes, that will be lovely. So I'll leave it up to you if you're ready. You know, we've been up here for a while, and I don't want to take too much of your time. But if you want to take a stab at that now, or we can come back and deal with it.
My worldview. It began to probably take shape around 70, 71. Again, the various conferences, the Black Power conferences, and I went to the constant, when I got back from my exile, I went to the Black Panther Constitutional Convention in Philly, you know, was there and, you know, learned stuff, met people, you know, and all of those conferences added to at least my thinking about internationalism, you know, my thinking about it, you know, this is connection. And see, Rob, you know, Ram had this connection with Rob. He used to get the Crusaders in to Canada, and people would go to Canada and bring them in and just circulate them in the U.S. And of course, you know, to talk about Malcolm, you know, was to talk about internationalism, you know, in terms of, you know, a view about internationalism. Rob, you know, was exiled as a part of internationalism, you know. So, you know, you had that. The going into the 70s with the founding of the African Liberation.
Due to time constraint, you can listen to the entire program on Africa World Now Project's SoundCloud. Just search Africa World Now Project. That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. Instagram at Africa World Now Project. Access to our other media platforms can be reached through the bios of our social media. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Muntali, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funa Ngonda, senior research content contributor and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior research content contributor and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, content contributor and filmmaker, Kurt Waterson, technology advisor is Byron Gray of Grayworks Technologies, and creative directors, international creative and artist designer, Tabassum Siddiqui and Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project can be heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcast service of Winston-Salem State University. Programs are archived and available on all podcast platforms. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.